Welcome to the Aspen UK podcast, where we bring people together to discuss topics that matter.
Hello, and welcome to this Aspen UK Mars webinar on the cutting edge of food technology, part of our fascinating sustainability series. I'm Pili Richards. I'm the head of the Aspen Institute in the UK. And in a very quick sentence, Aspen UK believes dialogue is essential, both to improving our understanding and to finding solutions to modern challenges. We enjoy using the globally recognised Aspen Institute's power to convene people, the best people, to discuss some of the most important issues of the day. And we know we attract some of the best people and some of the best minds to our public and private events. And today clearly is no exception. We are joined by three people I admire hugely. One is Ed Williams. He's the president of Edelman International and also the fabulous chair of the Aspen Institute in the UK. So, Ed, over to you.
Penny, thank you so much. And as I zoom in here, it's great to be with you today and to open this discussion. I mean, there are many topics that fascinate me. Today's discussion on the cutting edge of food technology is absolutely up there. Why? Because it's critical, really, when you think about it, for the world in the context of two massively colliding and intersecting issues. The climate emergency on one hand, and on the other, population growth. Remember, we are on track by 2050 to be a world of 10 billion people. We're going to probably add another 2 billion over the course of the next 25 years or so. Now, food production and farming has been the subject of innovation really since the early 18th century, as innovation in technologies and population growth required a more scientific approach to feeding people. Mechanization in the 19th century and, of course, industrialization post-World War II have been two big moments in this sector. But we are now, many believe, at the edges of what is possible using traditional approaches in areas like yield management and intensive farming. Indeed, the strategies we've applied to feeding the world have led us to a place where there are some real questions about whether the 21st century farming paradigm can be scaled further. Our water use, our soil use, the industrialization of meat production, all are on a path, some say, of diminishing returns. A UN conference on food and agriculture in 2019 suggested there were just 60 harvests left. Now, put alongside the climate impact of modern farming practices, contributing to a third of all global carbon emissions, as it does, something's got to give. And that answer, what's got to give, probably is going to come through food technology, and that is today's topic. Rewind just for a moment to 1701 and consider how the Age of Enlightenment propelled Jethro Tull, through the application of science and measurement, to invent the seed drill. This transformed farming. And you can start to see how revolutionary ideas like this can be really game-changing for our food systems. Now, today's Jethro Tull is with us in the form of Jim Mellon. Jim is a polymath. He's an investor, a thinker, a connector. He's an extraordinary communicator of ideas. Whether these ideas are communicated to children through a brilliant recent book about intensive animal farming, or in other books like Mood's Law, The Introduction to the New Agrarian Revolution, or his fantastic book on the age of longevity, Jim's ability to understand, communicate, and invest in new technologies is extraordinary. So you're in for a treat with Jim. Now, moderating this discussion is Thin Le Huynh. She is an award-winning multimedia journalist. She leads the Food Systems Newsroom for Lighthouse Reports. If you don't know about Lighthouse Reports' work, really look into it. It's an extraordinary organisation. They're a collaborative journalism effort coming together across Europe to work on public interest investigations. She's a real expert in this area, so we're in really safe hands with Finn. And for now, I'm going to hand over to you.
Thanks very much for the introduction, Ed. And Jim, it's a real pleasure to host this discussion with you. I think the first thing, let's just start off by setting the scene by, you know, could you just tell us how you got involved in the alternative protein sector?
Okay, well, Finn, Ed, Penny, thank you so much for having me from the rainy Isle of Man. I started life, as we all do, without really knowing what I wanted to do. And I started off as a fund manager. It kind of morphed into being an investor and creator of biotech companies somewhere more than 20 years ago. And from biotech comes this whole opportunity that we're talking about today, which is food materials, other things created in laboratory conditions, because biotech invented the process by which these things are possible. And so that's how it started. That's where we are now. And we have the extraordinary confluence of an absolute necessity, which I think almost everyone on this call, especially from the Aspen Institute, will agree, of doing something about climate change, doing something about global warming, being married with the technological opportunity that has been presented, and it comes from the biotech industry. So I'm very grateful that at a later stage in my life, I'm able to actually move a dial, because in everything else I've done, it's always been either jumping on a bandwagon or being part of the early stage of a bandwagon, but never being at the vanguard of something. And because myself, my household, everyone I know and love are wanting to do something about climate change as well as about the cruel treatment of animals, this is a very important mission for me.
So Jim, you know, you talked about obviously wanting to tackle climate change and also animal welfare and that natural progression from biotechnology to alternative proteins, but you're also a very, very seasoned investor, right? So I'm assuming that unless you saw that this was a growth area, this was something that is going to become very, very important in the future, you wouldn't have jumped in with both feet. Am I correct in thinking that? Is there anything else about it, this sector, that got you, you know, interested and be so closely involved?
Well, that's a very good question, because obviously without investment, there is no innovation. And, you know, being from the drug sector, legitimate drug sector, I hasten to add, the fact of the matter is that when drugs come on a market, wherever it is, they are generally relatively expensive to their cost of production. And that's because there's a long process involved in getting something to the market. And so it will be with the cell agriculture products as well. And yes, so if you don't have a price for innovation or a reward for innovation, then you just will get nothing done. So my main motivating factor, because I've got more than enough money and not enough time, is let's get the intensive farming industry, which is so ridiculously cruel and horrible and environmentally unsound and all that sort of stuff, down. But in order to do that, we have to make rewards for investors. And sure, there are going to be rewards for investors in this sector.
So essentially, it's a bit of a stick and carrot approach.
I think that's the way it is. I mean, Finn, I think that's the way it is with anything, basically. And, you know, we do have industries that we're going up against, the established farming industry, particularly the beef farming industry. And we do have naysayers in the scientific field who are going to say things like, this is not as environmentally sound as it appears to be, and all that sort of stuff, that Ludditism, which you might make equivalent to the horse and carriage industry at the turn of the 20th century versus the car industry. But ultimately, there are too many people in the world wanting too much protein. There's too much stress on the environmental system that we have at the moment. We need to find alternatives. And although these alternatives will take a long, long time to become established, they represent the future. And they represent a really good future, both for human health, animal welfare, and also for the environment. So it's fantastic all around.
So, Jim, let's go back to the basics. So when we talk about alternative proteins, in general, there are three main strands, right? We're talking about plant-based. So the plant-based burgers that we have started seeing in the last few years, in restaurants in London and New York and some of the, Amsterdam, for example, there's also the cell-based alternative proteins where you produce using animal cells, but without the intensive industrial scale animal farming conditions that you spoke about earlier. There's also the third, which is called precision fermentation, where you use this very age-old fermentation method, like we already do with brewing beer to brew proteins and stuff like that. Out of those three, what do you see as most promising, or do you see all three as part of the wider package of solutions?
Well, that was a brilliant summary of the industry. So then we're not interested in the plant-based solutions, not because there isn't some validity in plant-based foods, because there obviously is, but because it's a me-too industry. So you and I could set up a plant-based company tomorrow and there would be no IP, no know-how. And for the most part, and I'm not saying all of them, but for the most part, these products from plant-based sort of ingredients are highly processed. They're not much better for the environment. They may be even more environmentally destructive than the conventionally farmed foods, and particularly meats, and they're not much better for human health, in my opinion. And so what we've seen, especially during the pandemic, is a dramatic increase in uptake of those, and then a plateauing, and actually a sort of falling out of love with these sort of foods in recent times. So you've had Beyond Burger, Impossible Burger, meatless farms here in the UK, and so forth, that have become fallen angels. We're not interested in that. And it's partly because of the reasons I just mentioned, and partly because it's so easy for us to replicate those things that there's no fundamental advantage to investors for investing in that. So there are three other areas, and forgive me for adding another one, but there's the cell agriculture in the sense that you take stem cells from any living being, from anything, and it can be a plant or it can be an animal, and you basically use those stem cells to create new bioidentical meats or fish or leather or collagen or whatever it is in a laboratory condition. That's number one. That is the slowest but biggest potential part of what we're talking about today. And I was slowest in terms of it's a very scientifically complex thing to do, and it's also got lots of consumer uptake challenges. That's number one. That's about half the investments in the stuff that we make, in the investments that we make. And then the second, as you mentioned, is precision fermentation, which is, you rightly pointed out, is a brewing process that goes back a long, long way. The brewing process has been refined over the years, and this is where it gets back to biotech, because biotech uses this precision fermentation to produce lots of stuff. So insulin, for instance, is made using precision fermentation. Recently, everyone is aware of these weight loss drugs, Ozempic or Wegovy and so forth. They are used making precision fermentation. Almost all the capacity in the world to make things using precision fermentation is about 50 years plus old, and almost all of it is in Europe and almost all of it is used for biotech. There's very little available for food. However, it's going to be a massive, massive component of the food chain over the next 10 or 20 years. So I said that half and half of our investments are in precision fermentation and conventional cellular agriculture and none in plant-based stuff. But combined into those half and half is, of course, the picks and shovels that go to make these products, which you might consider to be a separate category or not. But we are now the world's largest producer of the plants, the factories that will make precision fermentation a large industry through our company, Liberation Labs. So we're doing three things. We are aggressively pursuing precision fermentation, which is here and now. It's on the market. The limiting capacity is the ability to make enough of it. It's approved. It's consumer uptake is no problem whatsoever. The second thing, which is more problematic in some ways, but more has more opportunity in other ways, which is traditional or the cellular agriculture field, as you described it very well. And the third is, how do we make the stuff that allows this stuff to be made? And so those are the three areas that we're investing in. And those are the three areas that will allow us to reduce, as Ed said at the beginning, the huge emissions. And it's somewhere between 15 and 30% that comes from farming, animal husbandry and other forms of farming as a percentage of total global emissions. And it's an easy win. It's an easy win in all sorts of ways, and we should be embracing it. It also reduces the need for food to be moved around the world in sometimes very insecure ways, as we've seen with the Ukraine war. And it also removes the incredible price volatility that we've seen in foodstuffs, which particularly is impactful on poorer people in the third world. So in my imagination and dream and my hope, we will stop eating 80 billion animals a year around the world, which is what we currently do, holding 10 billion at any particular time for slaughter. That's outrageous. We will stop using 80% of antibiotics in the food supply chain, which is what we currently do, raising the prospect of another pandemic, which would be much worse than the one we've just gone through, because it would be bacterial and we'd be microbially or antimicrobially resistant to that. We will stop animal cruelty, and we will stop the food insecurity that caused so much trouble during the early stages of the Ukraine war, causing the inflation that we're seeing as partly endemic around the world. All of that is possible. All of that is possible in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. So we are very lucky, as I said at the early stages of this conversation, to have the confluence of technology, which is here and now. We're beyond the lab stage. Everything is proven, except at massive scale, which is going to be a big but attainable challenge for us to meet. And the need for us, with possibly 10 billion people at some point in this century who are all demanding more animal protein but can't get it unless we want to collapse the world order.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. And I think one of the things, you know, you talked about the resource use. Animal agriculture use a lot of land and water resources as well. And, you know, these are finite, particularly fresh water use. And there's all these discussions around, you know, food versus feed on the land usage, whether, you know, in the small amount of land that we have, are we growing a lot of crops just to feed animals instead of feeding humans? And particularly with the food price crisis that we're currently going through, I think those are really important points to think about. I mean, is there, you know, you talked about the fact that you're focusing specifically or at least 50-50 on the precision fermentation aspect as well as the cellular agriculture. Is there any, you know, particular innovations that you have seen in your very, very long experience as an investor, but particularly in this space that you are particularly excited about?
Well, I will give you then an example of how we've kind of changed over the 4 years since we started getting involved in this. And as you well know, this has been a difficult period for venture capital. And nonetheless, we've managed to increase our assets, and they're genuine assets. They're not sort of BS assets that have been marked up and not subsequently marked down properly by 4 times over 4 years, which is a very impressive rate of return. And I know, because I just feel it in my bones, and this is not about money, but this is about demonstrating to the world that this is a viable and huge potential industry. I know this is going to be absolutely enormous. The total addressable market is about $5 trillion, which is significantly bigger than the whole vehicle market, including trucks, electric vehicles, conventional vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. This is huge. This is something we need to do every day. That's eat. And it covers everything from dairy to meat to fish to leather to egg products. I mean, anything that you can almost name, with the exception of crops and salads and vegetables, which are not viable in this context, can be done in the way that I'm describing, or I will describe later on in this talk that we're having today. In terms of great excitement, let's have a look at leather. Okay, so at the moment, leather for luxury goods comes from calves that are mostly grown in Austria. And they're grown in Austria because there aren't any barbed wire fences in the fields that they live in. And so they don't get nicked, and therefore the leather doesn't get damaged. But leather is made from these calf skins, and the calf skin dictates the size of the leather. And because, as you know, a calf has a very unusual shape, there's a lot of waste. So Vitro Labs, which is in California, is able to make leather in laboratory conditions without fur. So you don't need to go through a tanning process. It comes out as leather, but better, as good, and actually better than the leather that's grown in Austria, and is already selling to the major fashion houses in the world. And ultimately, it will dominate the leather market, for starting off with handbags and accessories and things like that, and then car seats, which are expensive, and then going into shoes and other leather products. This is happening right now, and the price comparison between the leather from the calves and the leather from Vitro is almost identical already. So you can see that in due course, the price of this leather will be lower without animal slaughter than the price of leather that's grown in the Austrian Alps. That's one area. The second area, and I'm really excited about this because, as you heard earlier before the show started, Ed and I are fanatics about dogs. And dogs account for 25% of the meat market in the UK. Pet food does. And similarly in the United States. And so it's a very, very large market. But the dog food, our dogs, I don't know if you have a dog or not, but if you do, they're eating the shavings off the abattoir floor. They're not eating the prime cuts or anything like that. They're eating all the stuff that can't be used for human consumption. If you can grow dog food in a laboratory and make it safe, you can extend the life of dogs because there's no hormones, no antibiotics, no bad stuff in there. And they're eating good food. And it might add as much as 2 or 3 years to the average dog's life. So we started a company called Good Dog Food. It is going to have the first cell cultured product on the market in Europe before the end of this year. Isn't that amazing? Absolutely amazing. That's within 3 years, we're going to have the first cell cultured company with a product on the market in Europe, despite all the regulatory hurdles and all that sort of stuff. Pets at Home, which everyone who's UK-based will be familiar with, the biggest pet company in the UK, 25% of the pet market and vet market in the UK, has invested in this company. One of their representatives is a director of this company. And I love this because it basically will extend the life of my, our seven dogs, and it will be a precursor to human beings taking up the uptake of cell agricultural products. It's so exciting. So, you know, as you say, long in the tooth investor, but super excited about, I mean, I just wish this had happened 30 years ago. And I would, honestly, I would devote my whole life to it because it is absolutely essential we do something about this for so many reasons.
And I think, I mean, those two examples are really fascinating, partly also because I think whenever we talk about alternative proteins, we see it as, you know, human consumption as meals. But the two examples that you gave are really interesting, particularly because there are all these, I guess, you know, additional wider benefits and usages that we don't even think about in terms of leather for fashion or, you know, pet food. Let's go back to human consumption. And I want to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here, because like you said, you know, there are naysayers, there are people who are skeptical, and a bit of a backlash or a pushback, whatever you want to call it, on alternative proteins quite recently, right? A lot of the initial enthusiasm has died down, like you yourself said, particularly when it comes to plant-based burgers. And they're now struggling beyond, you know, beyond meat, Impossible Burgers. There's also been a recent study from UC Davis, University of California, Davis, that looked at life cycle assessment of cellular agriculture and said that, you know, these proteins might actually be environmentally more destructive than conventional agriculture. And there's obviously debates around the methodology and the ingredients that they were examining. Would love to hear your thoughts on you know, how do you persuade these skeptics, or do you?
Well, it's a very good question, and I'm glad that you've brought it up, because, you know, we live in a world of fake news, and this is definitely fake news. I mean, the UC Davis paper is non-peer reviewed, as you well know, and it is based on information from 3 or 4 years ago. Now, when we started in this business, and we were one of the earliest people in this business, everything came out of pharma. So everything was based on pharma-grade processes. And there were two extremely expensive price points. One was the growth factors. Growth factors are, for instance, insulin, TGF, and so forth. And they, in the pharma industry, they don't really care what the price of those ingredients is, because the ultimate price of their product, which is the biologic or the drug, is extremely high relative to the cost of production. But in food and materials, you have to get the cost down. So I'm very pleased to be able to say that since they used these figures from 3 or 4 years ago, the price of growth factors has come down by more than 99%. Okay. The use of animal inputs, which was prevalent 4 years ago, and particularly the growth factors that came from fetuses from cows that were about to be slaughtered, doesn't exist anymore. And the trajectory... my book, which I wrote on this subject, is called Moore's Law, and it's because it's a riff off Moore's Law. It's about the price coming down every 18 months by half and the efficiency going up by double. We're actually way, way ahead of that curve at the moment in what we're doing. And so the price of a patty of beef made in a lab is down to about $5. It was $300,000 in 2013, and it's going to come down to below the price of conventionally priced food, which is where I call it griddle parity, which is another riff off grid parity, because the input ratios of protein to protein are as follows: 2-to-1 in cell agriculture, 25-to-1 in a cow, and 6-to-9, between 6 and 9-to-1 in a chicken. So the opportunity for us to have healthy food with no bad stuff attached. This is not Frankenfood. It's not using GM processes or anything like that. At a lower price than conventionally farmed food, at some time in the next 10 or 20 years is absolutely there. But it's going to take time and it's going to take a lot of capital investment. And so we are now facing the first sniper shots from particularly the beef industry, because that's the one that's got actually got some money and some lobbying power, not the fish industry or the chicken industry or anything like that. And they are going to do everything they can to stop this progression. But let's put it this way. In the last month, two US companies, without any questions, have been approved by the FDA and USDA with their chicken products in the United States. They are fantastic companies. We're not actually investors in them, but we absolutely applaud them as market pioneers. And within 5 years, you will see all this stuff on supermarket shelves. My prayer is that, unlike Beyond Meat or Impossible Burger or the plant-based food companies, which were not great executors of their business processes, that we get some companies that can execute well. But if they don't, I'm pretty sure that they will get bought up by the big food companies, because the big food companies can see environmentally positive, human health positive, animal welfare positive, better in almost every respect. And if we can make the farmers part of this process, which is what I would like us to do, have their precision fermentation machines on the farms or their bioreactors on the farms and give them incentives and to do so, then I think this is going to be absolutely fabulous. And you are right. You mentioned, Thin, that crops go into animals and they're very inefficient producers. Let me just put this in perspective. 70% of all crops grown on the planet go into animals. They're not the most profitable crops. 90% of agricultural workers around the world are casual laborers. They work in one thing and they work in another, including in agriculture, but it's not their primary job. In the developed world, it's less than 1% of the population that works in agriculture. Those people could be co-opted into this industry in a very positive and profitable way. And, you know, the Aspen Institute, of all institutes, is at the very leading edge of trying to reduce the impact of climate change. And I know that what I'm saying resonates there, because we're all mission aligned. We need to get intensive farming down. Intensive farming did not exist before the Second World War. Now chickens are three times bigger than they were in 1950 through hormones and just being confined to horrible spaces. I don't know if you know that the average chicken lives 26 days before it's slaughtered. 26 days. The average dairy cow is killed after 3 years because it's no longer productive, whereas it would live 20 to 25 years in a field. The average cow takes 28 months to grow to maturity and slaughter. Most of them never see the light of day. This is an unacceptable industry that needs to be gradually dismantled.
I just have a couple more questions. I see that there's quite a few questions coming through Q&A, so I do want to take it, but I just want to follow up on a couple of things. Number one, I really wanted to ask you about scale. And like you said, you know, there were two recently that the FDA in the US has approved. And so far there's one in Singapore, which is in chicken that's, you know, already commercially available. But based on what you said, you know, you seem to put sort of like the time frame as 5 years as when you expect the products to sort of hit the markets, or 5 to 10 years. That's the first part. The second part is, I mean, and you also yourself alluded earlier about sort of overcoming the consumer reluctance, particularly when it comes to cellular agriculture. How do you think that can be done? Can that be done? So it's a two-part question on, you know, scale, just double checking in terms of the timeline that you see. And also, even if they're available, we still need people to buy them and eat them, right?
Completely correct. So Thin, that's a great question. Let's start with precision fermentation. I think we can all agree that no one is going to be worried about whey, casein, egg products being made in laboratory conditions through precision fermentation. That's already on the market. The limiting factor is the capacity to produce. We're building our first plant in Indiana. It's $115 million. It will be operational in the last week of next year, and it will be immediately profitable. And by the way, we will build the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth plant, because there's no one else who's behind us on that. But we will need 3,000 plants in the United States to supplant the current dairy industry. So it's going to take a very long time for that to happen. And if you just want a little example of how bad the dairy industry is in the United States, in April, 18,000 cows died in an explosion in a facility in the United States. As I said, an explosion is absolutely appalling. So we need to do something about replacing that. And by the way, dairy cows are the biggest emitters of bad gases on the planet, and it's so easy to replace them. So 50% of our investments are in dairy and eggs. I don't think there's any issue about consumer acceptance about that. Everything that is made by Perfect Day, as an example, in the United States is sold straight away. So let's leave that to one side. That's 50% of the market. On the cell ag side, I mentioned that Good Dog Food will have a product on the market by the end of this year. I mean, that is absolutely amazing. So it may be sooner than 5 years that you'll see the stuff on the market. The big issue that I have is, are the companies capable of executing in a way that Beyond Meat wasn't? Or will those companies get sold to Unilever, Nestle, Kellogg's, Tyson, et cetera, who are a bit like big pharma relative to biotech? I don't really know the answer to that, but if I had to guess, being from the biotech industry, I would say that almost all of them will be bought out for their IP and for their know-how. And then big food will just become the distributor and marketer of this stuff. Can they scale? I personally have a big issue with companies that say, okay, we're making at 3 liter or 50 liter capacity now, and we're going to go to a pilot plant that might be 1,000 or 2,000 liter capacity, and then we'll go to full production. Because my view is that what's the point of going from 5 liters or 30 liters or whatever it is to a few hundred liters? Why not just go straight to the big capacity? Because either it's going to work or it's not going to work. But I do think it's going to work, and every indication is that it will work. This is a multi-generational thing. I'm not saying in 5 years' time or in 20 years' time, the whole of agriculture relevant to animals will be replaced by what we're talking about today. I'm saying that it will gradually chip away at it, and it will be the uptake. It will be the kind of relief valve, because all the Indians and the Chinese want more proteins, and we can't produce that protein without collapsing the world. It will be the alternative. Now, you mentioned plant-based foods, and it's absolutely true that, you know, Beyond Burger and Impossible have not done very well. But let's look at the other side of that, which is plant-based milks. And 10 years ago, you walked into Starbucks, you didn't ask for a soya latte or a rice latte or an almond latte or anything like that. And now it's in Starbucks, I think it's 35% of all the drinks are plant-based milks. So consumers are perfectly capable of moving and changing, and they will change. And in terms of cellular agriculture, because we are going for companies that are going after low-hanging fruit, either because it's a very niche area, which where the food is not particularly available, like Otoro cuts of tuna, or because it's stuff that people don't see, so it's in a pasty or in a patty or in a sausage, where, frankly speaking, someone walks into McDonald's, they're not associating a cow with what they're eating, they're just eating. That's 60% of the market, the ground beef market. I'm not too worried about that. And all the focus groups and all that sort of stuff suggests that people will be quite happy to try it, at least in sufficient quantity for the first few years of production. So let's not be negative about this, because if we're negative about this, we might as well give up on climate change.
Mm. I mean, and like you said, you know, earlier about eating is what we do every day, right? And just making that connection between what we eat, how it's produced, versus what it means for emissions. It's really interesting because we can afford not to drive a car, but we can't afford not to eat. And you know, that's something that I think there's a lot of potential. Last question before we look into the Q&A. There's a lot already. There last criticism, I guess, you know, want to hear your thought on how alternative proteins probably won't address the kind of, you know, economic and accessibility issues that have become so much more prevalent these days, that, you know, alternative proteins are not necessarily going to help people who are struggling with the food and fuel price crisis. Or do you see them differently?
I do, actually, because, you know, just looking at the pure economics, a cow takes in 25 times more food than it puts out over its life cycle, which is 28 months. And what we're talking about here is 2-to-1. So there's a more than 12 and a half times difference between the input and output. And ultimately, that means lower prices. Now, when I say ultimately, that may be in 30, 40 or 50 years' time. But isn't that great? I mean, you know, if it takes a long time to get there, but nonetheless, people are eating healthily and they're eating much more cheaply, that's a great achievement of humanity. So yes, it's not going to happen tomorrow morning. Yes, probably for the first 5 or 10 years, this will be something that will only happen in developed markets. Mm. But as with, you know, drugs that like penicillin that started off by being very expensive and only available to a niche few, but are now, you know, everywhere, I think this will be the same. And it's a development that humanity can be proud of. This is not something to be scared of, worried about, or anti. And but if you are anti it, you're probably a farmer. And what we need to do is to find a way of making the farming community pro this and not against it. And this is, you know, we've adapted. We started to create our own companies like Good Dog Food or Liberation Labs or whatever, rather than just investing in other people's companies. And so we're adapting now where we're going to try and help the message to be farmers, come join us. Don't be against us. You can actually benefit from this.
Yeah, so that's actually very segue very neatly into our Q&A, because there's a couple of questions around what does this mean for farmers? And, you know, you talked about working with farmers. If you could perhaps talk about what in reality or in practice, what would working with farmers look like? And there's also another question around what is the future, you know, for those who work in the farming sector and for, you know, whose livelihood agriculture it depends on. Where do you see that going?
Well, okay. I mean, those are great questions. So number one, let's look at the UK, because we're talking in the United Kingdom here. So about 1% of the workforce is engaged in agriculture. When the mines closed down and there was a huge disruption, there were 1.5 million miners in the UK. There's just a small fraction of that in the workforce now, relative to agriculture. The second thing is that most of agriculture will not be affected by what we're talking about, because you can't grow wheat, you can't grow salads, tomatoes and fruits and berries and so forth in laboratory conditions and make it economic. And there's absolutely no reason to do so. So all of that remains exactly as it was. And food that's grown on the farm for human as opposed to animal consumption is much more profitable than food grown for animal consumption. So we're looking at the direct animal husbandry and the crops that are grown to feed the animals. In the UK, we import about half of our food. That's ridiculous, frankly. We could produce all of our own proteins. We have the bioscience background, the life sciences background, the knowledge and the capability of doing all of that. Because of leaving the European Union, whether bad or good, we're no longer part of the common agricultural policy. So we can dictate our own agricultural policy. My general view is that rather than giving the money all to rewilding or, you know, biodiversity or whatever, why not give some of that money to farmers to situate the, especially precision fermentation as substitutes for dairy farming, fermenters on their land. So they become not accomplices, but they become economic beneficiaries of this change from current dairy practice to the new dairy practice, or indeed in the case of eggs, the same thing. And you, as with all of us on this call, will know that river pollution has become a big issue in the UK, and probably most people on this call realize that that mostly comes from chicken farms. Chicken farms are the biggest contributor to river pollution in the country. So there's all sorts of ways to create incentives for farmers to actually do something different and co-opt this new technology, as well as reducing our dependence on importing 50% of our food, which is just crazy. I mean, in the Second World War, the UK nearly lost the war because all the ships from America were being sunk by German U-boats carrying food to the UK. Why can't we produce all our own proteins in our own country?
Thanks for that, Jim. But I guess also, you have been emphasizing the intensive industrial scale farming. So I guess I should also just emphasize that's what you are particularly talking about. You're not, your strong words aren't against all forms of farming. You made it very, very clear that intensive farming, is something that's fairly new. And I think there are lots of ways of there's a lot of talk about, more ecologically friendly approaches to farming and producing. There's also a question around, you're obviously very passionate and it's all sounds great, but surely there must be a downside. I mean, what could be the negative side effects or externalities that we haven't thought of?
Well, I think that the main downside risk as an investor is the capability of the managements of these companies, most of which are new companies. When we started 4 years ago, there were 30 companies in the space. Now there are more than 300 around the world to execute properly. And I think that's going to be our major concern. In terms of the science, as I said, all of the companies that we've invested in, and there are 25 of them so far, have a product. So, you can look at anything from collagen to leather, as I mentioned, or egg products, or the variety of meats ranging across all types of meat, and or fish. And our company Blue Nalu will be on the market sometime at the end of next year in the US with a Otoro cut of tuna. It will make it at $25 a pound and sell it for $85 a pound to the Japanese, and the Japanese have agreed to buy everything that they can produce. So there are lots of execution risk, and that's an investor risk. But from a world risk, in 20 or 30 years' time, I don't know what percentage of food will be produced in labs or will be produced by novel ways, but I would think it's a very high percentage. And it's got to be a very good thing for all of us. You mentioned then at the outset of your remarks that water usage is a big problem. We could have water wars, mostly over the use of water in agriculture, if we're not careful. Water is a very, very serious problem around the world. I don't know if most people know this, but the amount of water in the world is exactly the same as it was at the formation of the world, but it's just distributed the wrong way. And there are now 8 billion going up to 10 billion of us all competing for water resources. Agriculture is the biggest, by far, user of water around the world. You've got deforestation. The size of whales every month is decimated in terms of forest around the world to cut down trees to grow soya beans to feed cattle. I mean, how crazy is that? So we're basically removing our carbon sink in order to produce soya beans to produce even more polluting items, which are cattle. I don't think there's anyone who's sentient, who understands the slightest bit of truth around the world, who wouldn't agree that what we're trying to do, and if we succeed or we don't succeed, we're going to have a good go at it, we're not doing the right thing.
Do you realistically see a world where every meat product is alternative?
No, because I think there will always be those people who would like to have their Wagyu beef, you know, massaged and fed beer, Kobe beef in that case. Yeah. And, you know, to see the little lamb that's trotting down the street and have it slaughtered in front of you. I mean, there are always going to be people like that. But I can tell you, it won't be me and it won't be anyone in my household. And as of the end of this year, the 7 dogs who live with us in Ibiza will be very happy with good dog food because they won't know any different, to be quite honest. They'll be eating the chicken that's made by good dog food.
A more technical question that's coming in that I'm just seeing. Have you looked at the carbon footprint of producing, let's say, a pound of beef versus an equivalent weight of cell-based meat?
Well, we have. And, you know, you referred to the UC Davis article earlier on, which was referring back to something that was 4 years old. Our general view is that this will use about 1% of the land. Okay. It will use about 50% of the energy given current processes. And that's all the way through the life cycle of both the cow and of the product from the cell ag. And that most of that energy is used in the stirring process. They need the mixtures need to be kept at a certain heat point, and they need to be stirred continuously. And that's where the energy usage comes from. It will use about 7% of the water, which is a fraction of the water that's currently used in agriculture. And obviously, it uses no antibiotics, no hormones, and all those factors will improve as scale improves. So yes, we have looked at it. It's a very big argument for us to make that this is environmentally much, much better. But as I said earlier, we're going to face all these misinformations, fake news, and so forth. And I just hope that we can overcome it.
I mean, in terms of energy, it's still important that the energy sources or the energy mix is also cleaner, right? Because if we're still using the same energy mix, that doesn't necessarily make it as good as it could be.
Absolutely. So we need to, in my humble opinion, we need to do 3 things, which is to increase wind, solar, and I don't know if this is according to Aspen rules or not, but we need to increase nuclear as well. And with those 3 things, and we can do it, we can be both energy clean, energy neutral, and we won't have this highly emitting industry, which is the current agriculture industry that we have in the world. Just let me get back to that original point I made about the number of animals that are killed every year. Mm-hmm. The average American, I guess there are some Americans on this call. I think Katie sounded American, but the average American lives 5 years less than the average Brit, despite spending a lot more on healthcare. And one of the reasons is because they eat so many animal proteins. It's not good for your health. And if you want to put that in the context of a life, someone in America will eat, on average, 7,000 formerly live animals in the course of their life. 7,000 animals. Those are beings that run around. I mean, I sound a bit spiritual on this, but I suppose I am. But, you know, this is my mission, and I don't want to come across as a sort of cultist at all, because this is actually a real business. It's a real opportunity. Mm. It's a real everything. Mm. But for me, let's stop doing it, because, you know, we have to be cognizant of the value of every sentient being, not just of us.
Mm. We are almost running out of time, but I do want to fit in a couple more questions. There is one, again, talking about societal hesitancy when it comes to lab-grown meat. A lot of people, or maybe some people, are a bit grossed out by this idea. And, you know, there is already a huge anti-GMO movement in the UK. And how do you plan to get around the idea around lab-grown meat? But I think one thing that I should point out again is you're talking about products that are non-GMO. So I think maybe the comparison is just to make sure that there isn't a huge movement against cellular agriculture in the same way that there is against GMO. How do you get around that societal hesitancy?
Well, it's a very good point. And these are non-GMO products. And so GMO is not the issue. The issue is it sort of Frankenstein meat? They're made from cells, and can it give you cancer and all this sort of stuff? Let's be absolutely honest and brutal about, you know, what people are going to say. First of all, you can't catch cancer. And secondly, everything you're eating in a hamburger or in a sausage or whatever is cells. I mean, they are cells. And so there's no difference between the cells that come out of a lab and the cells that come out of an animal. One is an efficient producer of cells resulting in meat, and one is a terribly inefficient and polluting producer of cells. And so the message that has to come across is that actually this is better in every respect than the other, and it's going to be a very difficult process for us to get across. However, we have the luxury of time because we just can't produce enough of this stuff for a long period of time to make any real dent into the traditionally produced foods. So as I said earlier, this is the Luddites versus the progressives, and the Luddites are going to have their victories, but ultimately the war will be won by the progressives.
Penny has appeared, so I think we should really wrap it up. But there are just two points that I think worth making, Jim, and as a bit of a takeaway. One was there's a question that we didn't get to, but I think it's worth asking, which is like, what will the impacts be of crops that will be grown for raw materials for cellular agriculture, whether they will also have the same type of negative biodiversity impacts? I think that's worth considering. And another comment is to go for a third party trusted reviewer like the Carbon Trust to sort of compare looking at the carbon footprint of cellular agriculture versus conventional agriculture. Now, just before move back to Penny, Jim, I'd like to give you a few seconds for a single final takeaway, final thoughts that you want to share.
I think the idea of the Carbon Trust looking at it, or whoever who is a trusted intermediary, is a very, very good idea. And absolutely, of course, that should be the case. In terms of growing crops for producing the sugars and starches that go in to feed the feedstock for both precision fermentation and for cell agriculture, let's just look at the input ratios I mentioned earlier, 2-1 versus 25-1. It's a no-brainer. Obviously, there's going to be a lot less crops grown in order to feed this revolution versus feeding cows, pigs, chickens, etc., which are much more inefficient. And one of the reasons, and it should be clear to everyone that they're inefficient, is because they're growing all sorts of things that we don't need. The chickens are growing beaks. The cows are growing udders, they're growing horns, they're growing heads that we just don't use in the food supply. So the inefficiency comes from the design of the animal. But if we can design a factory which is better than the factory that these animals represent, we get all sorts of benefits.
Thanks, Jim. Penny, I am going to pass back to you. Thanks very much again, Jim.
Well, thank you to both of you. I have been on the edge of my seat for an hour listening, making notes, being absolutely wrapped with fascination. You covered so much ground, both of you. Dog food, leather, longevity of animals, farming communities, historical farming context of farming, which I found fascinating. Water wars, food importation, just so much. It was an incredibly rich conversation, as I knew it would be. So thank you so much. Finn, thank you for leading this conversation in such interesting directions. And Jim, thank you for stretching our minds, for explaining complex issues so cogently, and for making us believe in what is possible for every sentient human being, which is I liked that you led us in that direction. Both of you, thank you so much for an incredibly thoughtful and thought-provoking hour. Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. Finn, Penny, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Aspen UK podcast. Our thanks to Hayden Taylor, who edited this episode. If you'd like to listen to more of our conversations, you can find all our past editions on our website, which is www.aspenuk.org, or obviously wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to stay up to date with all things Aspen UK, why not subscribe to our newsletter? You'll receive regular updates in your inbox about our live events, our leadership seminars, our fellowships, and so much more. You can register at our website, which again is www.aspenuk.org.